It's time for some Collective Wisdom, a podcast advancing the cannabis revolution one conversation at a time. We all benefit from sharing knowledge and experiences. So if you want to learn about the business of cannabis from those in the trenches, you've come to the right place. Here's your host, Lisa Tolner, co-founder of SensiChew.
Today we are speaking with Donnell Alexander, who is a writer and producer. Donnell grew up in Sandusky, Ohio, and moved to Sacramento, California when he was 18. He always had a gift for writing and storytelling and used those skills to build a career in journalism. In his early years, he covered local sports teams and then went on to write for all the major weekly publications from Chico to Orange County on topics important to California. After a stint at ESPN, the magazine, he wrote a memoir called Ghetto Celebrity and contributed to Time, KCRW, and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. He worked in Oregon on the Oregon Conversation Project, then back to California to become co-host and eventually produce the Weed Week podcast. Donnell presently writes for Weed Week California newsletter. Donnell Alexander, welcome to Collective Wisdom.
Oh, Lisa, thanks for having me.
The California newsletter, I think focusing on cannabis in California, of course, is essential to anyone who has a cannabis business in California. But also, as California goes, so does the nation, is the adage. So I'm very curious to know your take on what you're seeing in the industry and also from a uniquely California perspective.
Yeah, the California perspective is something that matters a lot. You know, I've lived all over since moving to Sacramento when I was 18, and I haven't lived in San Diego, I guess. That's probably my blind spot in California. All these different kinds of counties in Northern California, all the way up to Lake and Trinity County. Whenever you can bring all these places together for the community of California, it's a blessing to the people who are following it. They haven't had traditionally the sort of communication lines that other industries have had. And so word of mouth has been a lot of the way of things, you know, forever. And now that I have this newsletter where I can kind of bring all of the week's events together from all over the state, which is the size of the country, people are super into it. So the California that they see is obviously a chaotic one, but it's also one that has a lot of nuance. And as I try to curate these stories over the course of a week, I'm trying to show the facets of it. You know, the money game is something all into itself. My partner, Alex Halpern, who does the main WeWeek newsletter, focuses more on the business of cannabis. And the business of cannabis is undeniable. It always has to be part of the story. But the politics of it and the culture are really unlike anything else that goes on the planet. So I try to show this picture of California that's diverse in all of the ways. You know, the struggles that are happening at the county level are so multifaceted. I like to drill down on little pieces of what's going on in the state.
Right. And I think that's just incredibly important. The industry is, as you mentioned, it's complicated. There's so many different things going on all at the same time. It's a little bit of a juggling act for anyone who's in the industry, and it requires some patience and also some tenacity. And having that information is important, and that's one of the things that attracted me to your newsletter from the beginning. Is there a particular thing that you're seeing and hearing as you travel throughout the state that is a considerable threat to the success of California's cannabis industry?
That almost sounds like a trick question. Everyone's up in arms rightfully about the regulatory limitations in this industry. I don't think that those are necessarily going to be changed. So people just have to kind of settle in and accept that. Sure. The morass will change over time. But right now, we're just stuck with what we have, this building a plane as you're flying it. That's the analogy I hear sometimes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about social equity. We were talking about that.
Yes, please.
Earlier, because I think for a lot of people in the industry, it's seen as an albatross. Do we need to do the thing we explain what social equity is, Lisa?
You know, it's probably a good idea. If you want to dive in, please do.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to say it in general terms, because the fact is that it changes from jurisdiction to jurisdiction what the definition of it is. But we're talking about a sort of leg up for people who have been harmed in the war on drugs. Is that a good shorthand?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. You know, it means a different thing in Los Angeles than it does in Oakland, than it does in San Francisco. But part of this is that if you're getting into the industry and you're not from one of those communities, you need to partner with those people. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but just recently the state has listed all of their awards for counties, every county that's applied for money, and there's like $40 million out there. So everyone's going to have a social equity program. But how that is implemented is really been dodgy. It's been very slow. The people who have been promised a start in places like Oakland, San Francisco, and LA have done things like had to rent business spaces waiting to get licensed, and they haven't been licensed, and it's a great expense. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to tell you the great expense of just getting a license. And so people who come from disadvantaged communities need that leg up. And I don't think there's been a necessarily what we want to call an investment commitment from cannabis. You know, there's a lot of talk about wanting social equity to happen, but there has to be a cooperation that just hasn't happened yet.
Well, and I even see it not only cooperation, but I see it as an execution flaw. It's one thing to say, okay, we recognize you've been harmed. Here's $1 million to go get your business started. And then that's it. So even if you did have the funds, or even if when they release the funds, what kind of other support should be there? I remember reading a story, this was about a year ago, that supposedly the Bureau of Cannabis Control was going to offer even professional support services, accounting services, business support services to really give these social equity applicants and grant receivers the business support they need. I've run businesses my whole life, and I can tell you $1 million is a lot of money, but I've seen people squander $1 million many, many times in my lifetime because they don't know what are the important things in the business and what to spend the money on.
And absolutely. I have to be clear. I don't think anyone's getting $1 million. And the big problem is that no one's gotten it yet. They've had the promise of and not really had it. And they're more than anything. As right. I said in the newsletter this week, they're having their hopes dashed because they're in line for it. But what I really agree with you is this teaching component, it has to come from the partnerships. Up until this point, more predominant or maybe more publicized have been these relationships that are exploitive, where you're hiring someone who isn't qualified to be the owner in name, and they're just kind of a puppet. Mm-hmm. So we have to overcome that before we can get to the part where we're really making mentorship built into the program.
Well, that kind of thing, I mean, it's been done before. I mean, I think of some of the activities I've come across in my past lives and careers. They do that when you go for government contracts. You get brownie points when you submit a proposal, an RFP. And if you're working with a certified veteran or business, then you get added brownie points. And there are literally veteran groups that partner up and get a percentage who really don't do anything. Right. You're doing it for just the appearance. And so I'm seeing that happen a little. It's the games people play to get where they need to go.
I was looking at the Bureau of Cannabis Control's report on their state of grant funding. And I thought it is about the games that you play. You know, Stockton got $60,000, but Palm Springs has $150,000. I can't believe there's more need for social equity there. But there's definitely more political clout and maybe savvy. But what I think is important is that as I look at the list of all these people and their latest awards, is these are the first awards. We're always on cannabis time and everything happens so fast, but we're just building the foundation of something that's pretty unheard of. So I expect it to be bumpy, but I also expect people to be really vigilant about how it gets to shape up.
But at least it's heading in the right direction. And you're right.
You're right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's a rocky road for everybody. It would be hard to implement this if things were going well. But you know what a roller coaster it's been for the past couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's true. I mean, when big players are struggling, then you know the little guy. In fact, and maybe in some ways, the little guy has more staying power. You know, these bigger companies have huge overhead. And their burn rates are hefty. And a small company that can stay nimble has, in some ways, a better chance of getting through and kind of hunkering down through the hard times. But it's not easy for anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so hard to call just because planning and forecasting has become this impossible thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I've seen a little bit more support for social equity in Los Angeles, for example. There's a few groups down there that have actually formed with social equity applicants to pool their voice and have a little more impression, a little more visibility to the Bureau. Have you seen where that would help social equity applicants to join forces so that they can make more influence?
Well, I think that joining forces has been fine. It's not going to help you afford a place to have your dispensary. It's not going to pay your licensing fees. But I think that there are some people who've stepped forward and made a name for themselves and predictably brought a lot of critics in their wake. But like Fourth Movement approaches it from a capitalist side. The way that cannabis works is capitalism. I think one of the things that is problematic with the way the implementation is happening for social equity is that it doesn't really fit in with how capitalism functions. You know, there are not set-asides really, and this is a competitive industry. But Fourth Movement has a way of bringing people in at the level. They've secured the licenses and they're bringing people in who are talented, but they're expecting to make money off of it. Another program up north, Success in San Francisco, is privately funded, and they have a lot more freedom than San Francisco and Oakland. And they're not going to the cannabis industry. They're going to people who've had problems in the criminal justice system and connecting them with jobs. So I think there's more than one way to go about achieving social equity and bringing people to a place where they have meaningful ownership. And you know, we're not going to have it at all until we reconcile what's going on between the illicit market and the legal market. And that's one of my pet complaints, and it's an unpopular complaint about social equity, I have to say it though. If the best people are definitely out there still selling weed, you know that?
Yeah.
If you're so good, you don't even need social equity. I mean, I sound like some sort of unconservative here, but you can't get away from that. The best people are not in line to get in the business right now.
Well, you know, the industry has thrived, and you can see why it's happened. The industry has thrived for decades, especially here in California, and many people who are still active in the illicit market just look at it and say, I could deal with all these regulations, or I can just keep going the way I'm going. And it's sort of risk versus reward, too. If I don't think there's a very high risk that I'm going to be raided, and I can be a little slippery or a little bit smarter and discreet in terms of how I manage my customer base, and I don't use weed maps anymore because that's a target on my back,
Right. Then
why would I get involved in the messy, regulatory, heavy market? It's an easy answer.
So you would not be joining in 2020 if you were fresh in, Lisa?
Probably not. I'm a little bit of a rules girl. So for me, even though, you know, we all at some level operated under Prop 215, but I had many years where I was nervous and I was looking over my shoulder and worried about a raid and worried I'd lose my home. And there were many sleepless nights, but making it legal is ultimately where the industry has to go. And some people have to go first and they've got to make it happen if it's ever going to come into the light. And I'm a strong believer in the health benefits. So for me, it wasn't about the money, really. It was about doing something that's better for the planet, doing something that gives an important medical benefit to so many people. And in order to do that in the right way, I felt like for me, the path was doing it the legal way.
So, okay, I know you're the host and you're supposed to ask the questions, but I have one more question. What do you think the biggest impediment is to reconciling the illicit market with the legal market? Is it strictly about organized crime involvement, or are there other issues that people need to be thinking about?
Well, I think organized crime is always going to be there at some level. The minute you put heavy regulations on, you automatically cripple the legal side of the industry because they're having to work just as hard, maybe harder, with both hands tied behind their back. And so you're automatically putting them at a disadvantage. Now, if the regulatory wasn't so expensive and costly, then one would think that more of the illegal market would say, hey, you know what? I can make this work. I can come to the legal side of the industry. I don't have to be looking over my shoulder. I maybe have to pay a little bit of my profits, go to some of the compliance requirements and so forth. But it's not that heavy of a lift. I can do it.
I don't think the compliance component there, you might have underplayed that a little bit. I feel like that would be the biggest hindrance to someone coming in off the street.
Yeah.
I see people who are trying, who are focused, fail to do it. And that just makes me think if you're someone who's been sort of freelancing on the street, that's going to be a hard ask.
It is the way it is right now. I try to look at existing industries and how they approach things. And I know this is, you know, there's a health component. So you get health experts and you get the FDA involved. And so all these big lumbering government bodies suddenly are staring at all of this and critiquing it. But you walk into any aisle of Whole Foods, there's products there that are made, have a health and wellness spin, go down their health and wellness aisle.
Right.
They're not FDA approved. It says not FDA approved. A lot of them are small mom and pop companies selling at Whole Foods. So why can't that same model be there?
I think it can. And I one of the things I pick up, we were going to limit talking about the Weed Week newsletter, but it is my baby. I have to tell you, one of the things I love is just seeing a granular level look at how the counties are behaving and how these cities are changing their posture about cannabis because of COVID-19 and because of quarantine.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like we're going to see so much change as a result of what we've had to go through here. And I'm not just talking about municipal policies and ordinances. I'm talking about what places like Whole Foods are going to have on their shelves.
True.
Yeah. And in that, I guess it's a plus that we're going through it. I don't know.
Well, I think for the cannabis industry in particular, we're going to benefit from COVID. As awful as it continues to be and sad, and it's put this very scary spin on things that we just all took for granted. But it's really changed the face of the industry, and it's going to accelerate adoption from more places. Like you said, these small municipalities are now realizing that it's one of the few industries that still continues to grow and can help to generate revenue for their coffers. But at the same time, now it's shifting to more delivery services, which in many ways is great for consumers. Why stand in line if you can have it delivered to your doorstep?
And do you feel like there will be fewer dispensaries and companies who actually come through this period?
Yes.
That's inevitable, correct? All right, when we go back to that social equity conversation, part of the imperative there is that we are going to be a smaller industry after this. The amount of room for small new companies to make any kind of meaningful headway, the window's closing on all that. We're consolidating so fast, and makes that particular story, to me, have an immediacy that so many other things don't.
Yeah, I agree. One thing that kind of irks me, and I see this all the time, and I'm sure you've seen it too, where you have these conferences and reports where it says, start your cannabis business today. And I think to myself, that's awful. Because someone with a visions of grandeur who ponies up their $1,500 to attend a conference or whatever the cost is, or buy the special report, and like you said, the window's closing. They have no clue just what the limitations are till they really dive in and spend some money to quickly realize that there's not a whole lot of options.
When I came into this industry as a reporter, and I should tell you, I didn't know anything about pot before 2018. I did a series of articles that got me in at Weed Week, and I picked up a lot since then. Alex Alperin, the editor and publisher of Weed Week and co-host of the Late Lamented podcast, he appears on these shows that are outside of our bubble, our cannabis bubble, and you will be surprised at how little people know.
Yeah, well, they hear what the big media wants them to hear. And they see, you know, billions of dollars projected for California. And look at what's happening in these big companies with millions of square feet of cultivation in Canada. And
Well, let me clarify, because I think what you're saying is true. But as I'm preparing a piece for a mainstream publication about the issues we're going through, I'm finding that the complexities of what's happening with cannabis right now is too much for popular media. When things are varying from county to county like they do here, or never mind state to state, it's a job just making it palatable to these news platforms. And I'm doing well. I think it's going to be great. But I have had an education in trying to write about our issues in the bigger mainstream, because I think it's easier to have that gold rush, green rush mentality in the media.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it synthesizes it down to just one thing, making money.
Yeah.
And so that's the only story that it's really telling. But as you dive deeper, you see the chaos, you see the inequity, you see the hardship, all of the ugly parts of it start to come through. But you're right, the differences from county to county, town to town, they're exhausting, quite frankly. And anyone in the business knows this because they're having to deal with it. And even though you come up with certain ways to sort of make it work just operationally, it's still exhausting. Again, that's one more thing that costs you money to run your business, because you've got to now change the way you do things depending on who you're selling to. Right. And that's, you know, it's a pain in the neck.
Yeah,
but do it.
I spoke with someone in the industry who's been around forever, Northern California person, who said the state of the industry right now is all these people used to sell weed, sitting around watching their friends who still sell weed, having a great time while they're trying to deal with their taxes and compliance.
Yeah.
And so there's no more romance about this industry anymore. And maybe that's a great thing. Maybe that's a good thing. The traditional market seemed to do okay by itself before, but I feel like we're in a moment of time that will, in the specific sense, not in the general sense, where we're in a really strange period of time. But in cannabis, we'll talk about how weird and difficult it was, but we'll get through, hopefully with not just a few companies running the thing.
Yeah, I think about that sometimes too, that we'll reflect back on this and we'll think, wow, boy, that was crazy.
We'll reflect and go, remember when we went to dispensaries? That was weird.
Yeah. Well, you know what's so funny about the whole dispensary thing? I mean, you look at every other industry, retail is on the decline.
Yes.
And the reason for that is retail is expensive. You've got your overhead of your retail location. You've got security. You've got to train all those employees. A heck of a ton of payroll and payroll taxes every month. So retail is on decline everywhere else. I always grappled with that. How are the dispensaries going to sustain over time when every other major industry is getting out of retail?
Right. And it's just remarkable to be here in California where everyone waits and waits for this thing that's probably going to be an albatross not too far down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about that. Kind of goes back to the social equity topic. I was talking to a young woman in Oakland. She's been paying her rent, waiting for her social equity to come through, and paying rent on a facility for a dispensary for over a year. And so I was listening to her, I thought, you know, by the time she can even open, the dynamics of the retail is probably going to have shifted if it's another year.
And here
she will have paid rent for 2 years for nothing. Even just looking at our own customers, there's some of the smaller dispensaries are struggling now under the weight of COVID and compliance and everything. Some of them have been able to pivot and have done quite well with instituting delivery services and curbside pickup rapidly, but you know, that's not an easy task either. You've got to have drivers. Now you have to have all that insurance for all those drivers. And so although delivery service can be lucrative, it's a whole nother business in retail. And the smaller ones have had trouble. Took them a couple months just to get it figured out. So they lost some business. Now they're kind of creeping back out of the hole, but it's coming at a cost.
Now, my understanding is the delivery service is a much more nimble, accessible business, correct? I mean, than a dispensary. I would think that these would be the best times for those companies and making that adjustment. Is it just a matter of just getting through this period? I think the transition to delivery emphasis is going to be great for these companies that don't have deep pockets.
No question. I think that's absolutely true. I think the tricky part is it depends on the operational abilities of who's running the show.
Always, and, yeah.
So if you've got a small mom and pop or absentee owner dispensary, which a lot of them are, and your GM may not have a lot of business experience, it took them a while to pivot to get their delivery service set up because there's more logistics involved now. It's one thing when the customer comes to you and you just open your door and have your people there, but it's quite another when you're taking orders online, on the phone, and now you've got to set up delivery routes and schedules and train your people and make sure everybody has vehicles that run and that are safe and all the above. So it took them longer to work through the operational aspects of delivery. But I remember reading an article about 30 days before COVID kicked in, early February, where someone was predicting the demise of delivery services. And talk about a timing shift.
So why would there be a demise in delivery services?
Well, I think that they were, in this particular article, or this particular journalist was putting more emphasis on the importance of dispensaries and consumers wanting the dispensary experience and be able to go in and see all the products there and talk to the bud tender. And I would agree on that to a point. But after you've been in a dispensary one or two times, you're done. Right? Yeah. And you can do all of your research online. You can see all of your products online. In fact, in some ways, you can get more product research online because you can go to the manufacturer's website and you can read up on CBN and CBD and what are the advantages of microdosing instead of listening to a 25-year-old bud tender who may not be as knowledgeable as you would like.
Yeah. I've had some amazing young bud tenders.
But me too.
Your point is taken. But I think that take about dispensaries was really poorly reasoned. Whoever wrote that article, I don't know about that. I would love for it. I would love for that to remain a place. You know, just today I was reading an article about reading in public spaces and how that's just not a thing anymore and that we're kind of missing it even though we don't know it. Mm-hmm. The dispensary does function in the best of circumstances as like a gathering place when we're not just, you know, it's better than the grocery store.
Yeah. And, you know, it may come back when COVID finally goes away, and maybe the dispensary connection will be the ones with the lounge next door that's included. So it becomes like a coffee shop where you go, you can browse new products, you've got a relaxed environment where you can sit and enjoy a smoke and enjoy your doobie, visit with some friends or colleagues, and it becomes a gathering place.
And that's what we've been holding out for. And obviously, we've seen a couple of flares of it, but the culture of it, where it becomes something other than a novelty, we haven't even touched that yet. Obviously, we have this big interruption, but we do miss it.
Yeah, I think so, too. You mentioned that you may have a special announcement coming up that you wanted to share.
Yeah, well, you know, the Weed Week podcast hasn't been around for a while, and it's kind of a bummer that it hasn't been, because it was definitely popular enough. But I have some journalism that I'm really excited about. By the time this comes out, it should be out in the world. And it's not about cannabis, so I'm excited to get back into the world I grew up in. Sometimes I think about journalism as the real world, and cannabis is like this play world. I know it's very serious, but I just have so much fun in it. But I'm writing about the Black farmers movement in the Pacific Northwest. It's compelling to me because I think people growing food are very much in touch with other people. I'm from Ohio. What can I say? I think farmers are kind of more soulful. And I like writing about ways that people connect that aren't necessarily about politics or money. That's why I love cannabis. Cannabis helps people connect. But I have a scene in the story where a farmer is growing something for these people in a farm-to-table restaurant up in Oregon. And just the way they connected over food has stayed with me a lot. And it's the piece of journalism that I'm really excited about these days.
Oh, it sounds great. As an amateur gardener, I have my veggie garden, and it brings me incredible joy and relaxation. Mm-hmm. I go out there every day, and it's very rewarding. And what could be more meaningful than growing food that sustains other people?
Yeah. You know, I didn't know it takes 5 years to be considered a real farmer.
Wow.
But now that I think about it, of course, all the conditions and all these ground things that you have to familiarize yourself with, yeah, it's got to take a long time to become a farmer.
Yeah, I heard an interesting thing on NPR just last week, because a lot of farmers, of course, are struggling across the nation. But a lot of the Hispanic immigrants who've migrated here and have been working so hard to work the soil and really understand what it takes to grow are now being allowed opportunities to, they start out with a lease and eventually take over these farming operations.
It's like contract farming.
It's like contract farming, but eventually the original farmers, because their children don't want to farm because it's super hard work, the next generation doesn't want to do it. So these immigrants who've worked for them for any number of years end up filling their shoes and taking over their business and are thrilled to have it. They work hard. They understand farming. They love farming. Whereas the farmer's own children do not. And it becomes a great opportunity for the immigrants. And we need our farming. It's not like we can just stop farming. That's insanity.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was a great story.
I mean, that sounds great. And what I found in mine is that Black people in America, we come from farmers. That's what slaves were doing mostly. And it's something that's embedded in our history. The person in particular who's a vet just found himself reaching back to things his grandfather did and showed him. And it's weird and interesting how things stay sort of in your subconscious and you know how to do them, but you really didn't know you know how to do them. The quote I love about this farming movement is that there's a hardiness to Black people that they can reconnect with through this work. And I think through history, Black people have just demonstrated a hardiness in surviving here. And the idea of bringing it back to the soil just seems really poetic and interesting.
It sounds great. Well, you'll have to keep me posted on that.
Oh, I will. And I'm really glad you had me on here. It's a fascinating conversation. It's always good to hear people who built things talk about this industry. There are a lot of, I don't know how to say this without being damning, there are a lot of pretenders in this sphere. So I'm glad to talk to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. One of the reasons I even wanted to do the podcast in the first place is because I was getting so much disinformation, and a lot of it was just exaggerated is what it really came down to. And I thought, well, you know, being in the trenches myself, I want to hear from other people who were also active in the industry, find out what's really going on with them, what's their take, and just put a little more truth to it, I guess.
Yeah.
And then I get to have wonderful conversations with cool people like you. So it works out.
Yeah, this is good. Very good. Thanks for thinking of me.
Well, Donnell, thank you so much for your time today. How can our listeners learn more about you and Weed Week and what you're up to?
Well, weedweek.net has the newsletter and the podcast and a lot of stories. We've hired a bunch of new people lately. My portfolio with all of my film and radio and storytelling stuff is at Contently, C-O-N-T-L-Y, Contently.net, Donnell Alexander, and on Twitter, I am at Donnie Shell, D-O-N-N-Y-S-H-E-L-L.
We've been speaking with Donnell Alexander, professional writer and storyteller. He's currently at Weed Week. This is Lisa Tolner from Collective Wisdom. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be well. Hello, folks. I wanted to give you a little more information on equity applicant fund amounts. On the show that we just recorded with Donnell Alexander, I did state that equity applicants were receiving $1 million, and that is actually a misstatement, so I just wanted to provide a disclaimer on something more accurate. The equity grant report that is on the Bureau website published as of July of this year, 2020, and it breaks down both the equity funds given out in 2019 as well as funds that have been allocated 2020. So far, it's totaling $40 million across the entire state. And really, the funds are much more modest. For example, as Long Beach, 2019, they received $914,000. And they estimate that there will be 15 equity-owned businesses that will share in those grant funds, the average being $60,000. And it should be noted that funds have yet to be dispersed in Long Beach as well as many other cities. Quite a few of these local jurisdictions are planning to provide fee waivers to cover other cannabis city fees, such as permitting, plan checks, inspections, and so forth. But it is important to realize that this money will not go far. The cannabis industry is a very expensive one to operate in. Simple basic business costs, insurance, 2 to 3 to 4 times as much for business and auto insurance, rents 2 to 3 as much. So it's an expensive industry, and the grant recipients are going to need every penny they can get. And I just wanted to clarify that $1 million reference is incorrect. It's really more in the neighborhood of an average of probably $20,000 to $50,000 per applicant. Could be more in some jurisdictions, could be far less. Just wanted to provide that update, and thanks for listening.
That's this week's episode of the Collective Wisdom Podcast. Join us each week for another episode on OC Talk Radio, streaming on Thursdays at 3 p.m., and you can download Collective Wisdom wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to visit cacollectivewisdom.com or email us at collectivewisdompodcast@gmail.com to join the conversation. Thank you for listening.